Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Eric Bentley. I represent the appellant, Mr. Gott. File number 33792. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would like to focus my argument on one central point, which is the enforceability of Mr. Gott's non-compete agreement. Mr. Gott is an insulation salesman. He has a trial court judgment against him in the amount of $656,000 for breaching his non-compete. He went to seven claims were tried against him. The breach of the non-compete is the only claim that resulted in liability and damages against him. As the court is aware, non-compete agreements in Colorado are against public policy and void unless they fit into one of several narrow statutory exceptions. The first task for a jury facing breach of non-compete claims to determine whether the non-compete is void or enforceable. And I'd like to start by addressing an error in USI's brief on that issue. USI contends in its answer brief that it is the employee's burden to demonstrate that the non-compete is unenforceable. That is wrong. Under the Phoenix Capital case, which is cited in all of the briefs, it is the employer's burden as a threshold element in proving breach of non-compete to prove that it fits within a statutory exception and is enforceable.
Mr. Bentley, let's assume that's all correct. The jury was not instructed here to determine that issue, correct?
Correct.
And there was no request made for an instruction by either Mr. Gott or by USI that the jury be so instructed, correct?
Incorrect.
Incorrect?
Yes. USI has that either wrong or very, very finely construed to give a misleading impression to that effect in its brief. As the court is aware, we submitted a supplemental brief that was denied to address the issue. Let me give a record citation and describe the instruction.
Well, based on the record, alone, was there a request from your predecessor to instruct the jury that they first needed to decide whether the covenant was enforceable?
Yes, absolutely.
Where is that in the record?
1 minute, John. It's if I give you the CD page, is that fine? It's at the charging conference on the last day of trial on pages 2933 to 2934 of the CD.
And do you have a recollection of exactly what was requested?
I do. Quote, this is a tendered instruction, quote, Mr. Gott cannot be bound by and therefore cannot have violated the non-compete agreement unless you find the agreement protected trade secrets.
Well, trade secrets wasn't the issue in this particular argument, was it?
There were two issues. So it was up to USI to determine which statutory exceptions it relied on. It relied on two of them, trade secrets and the management personnel exception. It was Gott's trial counsel's theory of the case that there was only evidence supporting one of those exceptions, trade secrets, and accordingly, Gott's counsels tendered a proposed jury instruction that reflected that theory of the evidence and of the case, which was that they had to fit it into the trade secrets box. And right there on the same page in the charging conference, counsel for USI responded, no, actually, we think it fits into two boxes. The trial court at that point had an alternative. The issue had been raised to the trial, brought to the trial court's attention. Two kinds of instruction had been suggested. That is, the one by Gott's counsel, which is just instruct on trade secrets, and the one by USI, which is instruct on both exceptions. The issue had been briefed from the start to the end of the case, preliminary injunction briefing.
Let me just stop. Did USI's counsel tender a proposed instruction on both?
No. They responded, we object to that instruction, we rely on both.
Okay.
And the trial court went off on a little bit of a tangent and said, I'm going to deny it, I think we have enough instructions.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead. No, I appreciate the clarification. So the issue had been briefed extensively, preliminary injunction, summary judgment, and trial briefs. The court and all the parties were very well aware this was one of the central issues of the case. Neither side had submitted it in their pretrial jury instructions. We submit that was USI's burden to include it as a threshold element of their claim. Gott's counsel tried to rectify that error by tendering this instruction in the charging conference.
Well, Mr. Bentley, let's go back to whose burden it is to tender an instruction. If your position is that it was USI's burden to tender an instruction on both, and it did not, the issue never went to the jury, correct?
And it did not, and Gott's counsel tendered on one, and the court denied both.
So the court's denial of the trade secrets instruction did not preserve the objection as to the management exception, did it?
I think, Your Honor, that, and I'll give a citation for a case I rely on called Blue Flame Gas, 679 P2nd at 587, Colorado Supreme Court, 1984. An objection to jury instructions is preserved for appeal when the objection or proposed instruction sufficiently directs the court's attention to the asserted error and provides the court with the opportunity to correct it. And one more case, DeBose, D-E-B-O-S-E versus Bear Valley, 890 P2nd at 222, reversed on other grounds. The trial court has so when an issue is brought to the trial court's attention, it has the obligation to correctly instruct the jury, even if the tendered instruction was imperfect.
Are either of those cases cited in your opening brief?
No, Your Honor.
So how can we pay attention to them if they're not cited in your brief? This was a supplemental authority.
Yes. Yes. And obviously, I'm here. I will be the first to admit that the principal briefs on behalf of my client are poor. I'm here doing my best to bring to the court an issue that I believe to be a really fundamental error made by the trial court that took a central issue of the case entirely away from the jury. I believe that it was very poorly raised in the opening briefs, but the issues were at least sufficiently put before the court that the briefs require the court to engage with this issue, even though they're poorly done, and I have no apologies for the quality of those briefs. We think that it's sufficiently before the court that when the court then engages with the central arguments of insufficiency of the evidence and inconsistent verdicts, that it can't engage with those without coming back to this issue that there's this fundamental gap. There's a jury with no instruction, a jury that's not told that there is even an issue about the non-compete being presumptively void, not told that anything about essentially the central issue in the trial for Mr. Gott. It's as if you had a computer and you put in the data, but you don't put in the operating system. They have no instruction, no idea that they're supposed to deal with this issue. I believe USI is going to argue, here's the evidence by which they could have made these findings, but they couldn't have if they didn't know this was an issue they were supposed to address. So if one looks at the record as a whole, the record does not support the conclusion. The record does not support the possibility that the jury might have addressed either statutory.
You agree that this jury would have had no reason to think that it had to conclude that having a management position is the basis for the enforceability of a covenant, correct?
It has zero basis to conclude that.
And your client didn't offer an instruction that told him to do that. The trade secret part,
yes,
but not the management part.
Correct.
Right. And the plaintiff in the case, USI, you're saying they have a burden to tender to the court what would actually be kind of an affirmative defense of the defendant?
Well,
you're not a counterclaim.
Yeah, we don't believe it's an affirmative defense. We believe it's an essential element of USI's claim, and that's under the Phoenix capital case. Is the threshold element before they can proceed to prove breach of a non-compete.
Mr. Bentley, even assuming it's an element, many times juries aren't asked to try every single factual element in a case because there may be a dispute between the parties only as to one or two of a five-element theory. That happens all the time, correct?
Yes.
And then when someone tries to raise it on appeal and says that it was in error, they're going to get the same questions we're posing to you. If a jury isn't asked to determine it, and I guess you're saying it's USI's fault, not yours.
We do say that, but our primary argument is that the trial court's error, and it's a very fundamental error. The trial court was advised.
But if it wasn't made, it's got to be a plain error review, at least as to the management exception.
No, Your Honor, I disagree with that, respectfully. Because I think there are many cases out here. I think the recent Schuessler case by Your Honor stands for the principle that a party is entitled to an instruction that's consistent with its theory of the case. Gott gave an instruction consistent with his theory of the case, which was that there was not enough evidence to support USI on the management exception. USI responded, no, we rely on both exceptions. That put it before the court. And
you just said the management exception, but I think you meant the trade secret exception, right? The instruction you offered was on the trade secret.
Yes, thank you. I reversed that.
I said management, but you didn't say
that. Thank you. I'd like to reserve my remaining time if I may.
May it please the court. G.P. Phillips, today on behalf of United Subcontractors. The court should affirm the judgment in favor of United Subcontractors because Gott's arguments have all been waived. And to the extent the court reviews them, they do not provide a basis for disturbing the jury's verdict. I'm going to focus most of my argument on what Mr. Gott's new counsel was addressing to the court just now. This argument was waived with respect to the instructions to the jury on the trade secret and management personnel exception to the non-compete statute. Mr. Gott failed to raise these arguments in his opening or reply brief. This court should not entertain further second guessing by Gott's now third attorney in this case. The discretion that Mr. Gott wants this court to exercise is reserved for very rare instances in civil cases, only where it's necessary to prevent manifest injustice. I would submit that this is not a case where there's any sort of manifest injustice. Allowing Gott to raise this argument now would impermissibly condone changing theories on appeal. I'll get to Mr. Gott's fundamental theory on the manager exception in a moment. However, now he's trying to argue that the manager exception and trade secret exceptions should have been tried to the jury. However, his attorney made a deliberate decision not to have the manager exception tried to the jury. Allowing Mr. Gott to present this new argument now on appeal, after briefing is closed, would create an incredibly slippery slope where a disappointed litigant who has lost at trial hires new counsel who has months to prepare new arguments in between close of briefing and oral argument to essentially raise new arguments that were never tried at the district court level. Contrary to Mr. Gott's new argument, the application of the manager exception was not an issue pressed at the trial court by Mr. Gott. Contract invalidity was not raised as an affirmative defense in Mr. Gott's response to the counterclaims asserted by United Subcontractors. The trial management order says nothing about the manager exception. Under Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure, 16F(5), the trial management order controls the proceedings in the case. Any modification is allowed only where the need for modification could not be reasonably anticipated. If this were an issue before the trial court at all times, as Mr. Gott's new counsel would suggest, it would appear in the trial management order. It was not there. The notes to Rule 16 indicate the purpose is to force counsel to make decisions on what theories to try to the jury. Mr. Gott made a decision on what theories to try to the jury, and it wasn't on the management personnel exception.
Mr. Phillips, the argument seems to be that it was USI's burden to present a jury instruction to the court dealing with the management exception and or the trade secrets exception. What's your response to that?
Our response to that is that that issue has also been waived, Your Honor. It was not raised a single time before the trial court by Mr. Gott, nor was it raised in his opening or reply brief to this court. There was no basis for United subcontractors to understand that this was even an issue in the case.
Do you agree with Mr. Bentley's statement that, in fact, it's the employer that has the burden to prove that the covenant not to compete is enforceable?
I disagree with that assertion, Your Honor. An affirmative defense that renders a contract void ab initio, a defense to a contract claim that renders the contract void ab initio is an affirmative defense. I would set the court to Wiseco versus Colorado Regional Construction. The site for that is 251 P3rd 489, pin site 492 to 93, and the second footnote. It's a Colorado Court of Appeals opinion from 2010. The Supreme Court has held in the Western Distributors Company versus D'Addosio case, that's 841 P2nd 1053, that of course the defendant bears the burden of proving by preponderance of evidence any affirmative defense to the plaintiff's contractual claim.
Okay, I guess we're just playing with semantics here. I was always looking at a breach of contract claim. The person asserting a breach had to first establish that a contract existed.
However, there's no dispute that there was a contract that was signed by Mr. Gott.
So you're saying
that if he wants to show that the contract is invalid, i.e. that it is illegal under public policy, that is an affirmative defense under
the statute that allows enforcement of covenants not to compete. Does that statute provide that that is an affirmative defense or an element of the claim?
It does not provide either way, Your Honor.
Is there case law under the statute that clearly says whether it's a trade secret or whether it's management is an element of the claim that the employer has to prove?
I have not seen a single case that says that the application of the statute is a prerequisite.
Conversely, are there cases that say assertion of the trade secrets exception or the management personnel exception is a burden that the covenantee?
Not directly, Your Honor. However, the Spriggs and Aetna trailer case, Colorado Supreme Court case from 1970, establishes that it's the burden on the party challenging enforcement of the non-compete with regard to reasonableness to establish that it is unreasonable in scope or, quote, for any other reason. That case was decided 3 years before the non-compete statute was adopted in Colorado. There is a longstanding policy in this jurisdiction for the common law to carry over when there's no express derogation of it in the statute. So Spriggs remains good law and points to the fact that the burden is on the party challenging the non-compete statute to establish that it's not enforceable. Prior to the non-compete statute's adoption, you could only challenge a statute based on reasonableness. The statute gave new grounds to challenge the enforceability of the non-compete statute. I would submit that it is still the burden for the party challenging the non-compete statute to prove its unenforceability.
Otherwise, you'd have to prove
it's reasonable, the distance is reasonable, the cities are reasonable, the date, time, things that you don't even know if he's complaining about.
That's correct, Your Honor. In addition, unreasonableness remains a grounds for a party challenging a non-compete to challenge the enforceability. It would make no sense to have two different burdens on one side proving the enforceability under the statute, and then on the other side, party challenging reasonableness to prove that it's unenforceable. It would be utterly confusing for the jury. And the case I would say that unreasonableness is still a requirement or is a basis for challenging enforceability is the Dish Network case that it's cited throughout our answer brief. And I would point out that the language in Phoenix Capital that Mr. Gott relies on is mere dicta in that case. It doesn't appear that anyone was actually challenging that issue. It was just inserted in there as dicta because the issue was not contested by any of the parties.
Mr. Phillips, did Mr. Gott challenge the reasonableness of this covenant?
Not in terms of geographic scope or duration, Your Honor.
Was there any argument made during closing arguments? I seem to remember something being said about this, that this was an unreasonable covenant.
We actually don't know what's in closing argument, Your Honor, because Mr. Scott did not have that transcribed.
That's right. I think I may have seen it in the brief then, but I'm something, maybe in the jury instructions? Is there something in the jury instructions?
And what was the question about what was in the jury instructions, Your Honor? I'm
sorry. The reasonableness of the covenant, not which exception applied, but the reasonableness of the covenant.
I do not believe that reasonableness of the covenant was asserted in the jury instructions tendered by Mr. Gott at any point, Your Honor.
There was a theory of abandonment, was there not?
There was a theory of abandonment, and that, Your Honor, is the cessation of business argument that's right. Being advanced by Mr. Gott now. However, that theory does not apply to the management personnel exception. That is simple. That is solely under the sale of business exception. That applies in the circumstance where you have goodwill at issue, and the purpose of the statute is confined to protecting goodwill associated with the sale of that business. If you close the line of business, there's no purpose any longer to the non-compete because you're no longer protecting goodwill. The goodwill's gone. The business is not operating. You don't have that with the management personnel exception. The management personnel exception, you have a situation where, as it's explained in the Reed Mill and Lumber case, that the purpose of the management personnel exception is to protect high-level business strategy. So it's different from goodwill. So ceasing a line of business is not applicable in that circumstance. It's protecting what the manager knows. And that brings me to Mr. Gott's argument on the assertion that the cessation of business should have been a basis for overturning the jury's verdict. United Steel Contractors would submit that Mr. Gott has waived this argument. There was no argument on instructional error in either the opening or the reply brief. Instead, Mr. Gott's counsel invited this error by stipulating to the breach of contract instruction submitted by United Subcontractors and insisted that no instruction be given on the manager personnel exception. And it's important to recognize that when you have under the non-compete statute.
Say that again. At the jury instruction conference, Mr. Gott's counsel argued that no instruction should be given on the management exception provision?
That's correct, Your Honor. He actually insisted that no instruction be given on the manager personnel exception.
contrary to what Mr. Bentley suggested should be inferred by tendering the trade secret.
That's correct. He tendered a trade secret exception instruction, Your Honor, that would have instructed the jury that it was to find the non-compete unenforceable if it found there were no trade secrets. However, he insisted in the very next breath that no instruction be given on the manager personnel exception.
And that's in the record that is transcribed.
Absolutely. It's cited in our answer brief, Your Honor.
Thank you.
At that point, there was nothing for the trial court to do. It couldn't instruct on any of these. Mr. Gunn at that point had waived any basis for challenging the application of the non-compete statute in this circumstance. Once you have one of the prongs of the non-compete statute applying, it doesn't matter if the other ones apply or not. Having conceded that there was no basis for instructing the jury on the management personnel exception, because I think any reading of the record in this case would show that Mr. Gott was indisputably a manager for United Subcontractors. He admits at trial that he was in charge of Firestop, which is the type of insulation product, that he was given that responsibility shortly after he started working for United Subcontractors, that he supervised at times six or more employees. There's testimony in the record showing that the Powers Branch had only 50 employees. That's 10% of their operation. And they had complete control to terminate employees under his control. That would be enough evidence to show application of the manager exception to the non-compete statute. I see that my time is up. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bentley, I think you have about 3 minutes and 41 seconds to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I'll start with close to the end of Mr. Phillips' argument, where he said that Scott's counsel instructed the trial court not to instruct on the management personnel exception and thereby waived. This is where the issues of who the burden of proof becomes really central. I think if you look at the statute, you'll see it deals with entirely different issues than the common law case that preceded the statute that Mr. Phillips was referring to. That had to do with reasonableness. You know, is the compete, non-compete 5 years? Is it over the whole U.S.? What's the burden on the employee? Statute, if you just look at the face of the statute, it puts the burden on the employer because it says it's void unless you put it in these exceptions. That's quite central, because then it becomes the employer's burden to identify for the court which exceptions it relies on. It has four to choose from. In briefing through the history of the case, it had relied on two. The court earlier in preliminary injunction had said, we don't find either applies. At the end of trial at the charging conference, it was Gott's theory of the case that the evidence only supported one. That was Gott's right to interpret the evidence that way and require USI to come back and give its interpretation of the evidence, which it did. It said both apply. The colloquy went back and forth. Gott's counsel said, no, I think the evidence only supports one. That wasn't a waiver. That was an argument of whether or not there was sufficient evidence to support USI's theory of the case, or whether the instruction should be given based on Gott's theory of the case. And at that point, it became the obligation of the trial court to resolve that issue.
Was a mid-trial motion to dismiss made by Mr. He wasn't really a plaintiff, but it was a mid-trial motion made by Mr. Gott to dismiss the contract claim?
Not on these issues.
So these were never raised at mid-trial?
No, Your Honor. But raised there, we believe that at that point the court had the burden to correctly instruct the jury. The court had all the information needed because it had the trial briefs, which addressed this at length. And I'll give a citation. The trial briefs, go to the CD at pages 1268 and 1257. You'll see that was before the court. If you go to the CD at pages 184 to 185, you'll see the court's prior ruling in Gott's favor on these issues. the court had the obligation then to give a correct instruction. So this was not waiver, this was presenting the theory of the case, and USI responded with its theory of the case, and the court needed to resolve it. I don't have time to address the record in any detail, but I think from the briefs, the court can determine for itself that it was a wide open issue. The evidentiary issues were wide open. The jury found there was no misappropriation of trade secrets, following finding the same way that the court had ruled earlier in the case. All of the testimony, the bulk of the testimony, is that Mr. Gott was a salesman. There was some limited testimony that he managed these very few people who were a tiny fraction of the work done by USI, but all was under the authority of Mr. Gott. With that, there are no questions.
Thank you, counsel. Okay. Thanks to both counsel. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.